Good afternoon. It is Wednesday, June 9th, 2021, and this is Ozarks at Large. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. In just a few minutes, we'll talk with Reverend Chantel Hinton Hill, equity officer with the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, about a new fellowship for faith leaders to help equip them with skills to discuss poverty in Arkansas and make a difference in the long-term approach to poverty. In our second half hour, we'll hear the voice of John McDonald, the legendary track and field coach at the University of Arkansas. He died yesterday. In March 2013, he came to our studio to talk about his then-just-published memoir. After Ozarks on NPR's Here and Now, a writing project is trying to help doctors and nurses deal with the trauma of their experiences over the past year caring for the dying. Here and Now begins at 1. COVID-19 numbers are up in Arkansas after the most recent 24 hours of testing. There are 231 new cases and three more deaths from the virus in that report. Hospitalizations increased by 29 patients. Active cases increased by 62. Northwest Arkansas hospitals are noting a rise in COVID-19 patients over the last 7 days. Though the numbers are smaller than the winter spikes in the region, a press release from the Northwest Arkansas healthcare community notes a 90% rise, 19 people, in COVID-19 units compared to last week. That same press release urges people 12 and over to receive a COVID-19 vaccination. State employees in Arkansas will soon have the opportunity to earn a raise as a result of their work during the COVID-19 pandemic. Governor Asa Hutchinson announced yesterday a 3% performance or merit bonus that will be given to state agencies that in turn will distribute to its employees based on their work. He says the state's employees showed dedication, resilience, and flexibility during the pandemic, circumstances he says no workforce had experienced for a century. The governor says this pay amount to state employees is the largest one since he took over as governor, costing the state around $11.2 million in state general revenue and a total of $28 million from all sources, including federal ones. The governor says this amount will be added to the employee's base pay instead of making it a one-time bonus. The University of Arkansas track teams begin their quest for national titles in Eugene, Oregon today. The women's team is ranked 5th in the country and defending national champions. The men are ranked 18th in the latest national poll. This NCAA meet will continue through Saturday. National Weather Service is giving us a 50% chance of rain tonight, a 40% chance tomorrow, best chance of rain tomorrow in the morning. Lows tonight from 69 to 73. Highs tomorrow, 88 to 91 across the listening area. This is Ozarks at Large. A new fellowship from the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation will help guide faith leaders champion economic justice and anti-poverty work. The MICA Fellows Program will last 9 months and is intended to be a statewide initiative attracting men and women, brown, black, and white people, residents of rural, suburban, and urban Arkansas. Through an intense training program, fellows will discuss topics like how to write a sermon about poverty in Arkansas and what to do if you want your community to do more than food pantries. Yesterday, we talked with Reverend Chantel Hinton Hill, equity officer at Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation in Little Rock via Zoom. She says the foundation has been engaged in efforts to strengthen faith leaders' connection to work alleviating poverty in Arkansas.
We have really been working for quite some time. The Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation has been working to see what kind of energy there is around faith leaders in Arkansas and their intersections with doing justice work in the state. And so for several years, we've been convening, pulling people together to meet and talk about subjects such as race, the economy, people's communities, how does the church intersect with that? And for several years, it was just a conversation. It was just a space for clergy people of all different backgrounds, not just of the Christian faith, to come together and talk and be together. But here recently, we started to see that as we entered into the pandemic, essentially, that there were a lot of ways that Arkansas just wasn't ready to handle a pandemic. Our economy wasn't ready. You know, our public health system wasn't ready. A lot of different things that we weren't ready to handle. And so we started thinking, well, who would have the interest and, you know, commonality in wanting to speak to being prepared for this type of public crisis in the future? And we could think of no better people than people of faith. We know that people of faith were deeply impacted by the pandemic. Most of our churches locally really filled in the gaps for people who were in need, who had lost their jobs, who fell on hard times. And so we said, you know what? Why don't we figure out a way to invest in leaders across the state to become even more vocal pieces of us helping Arkansas to become more prepared to support people who are experiencing hard times financially in the future.
In this 9-month fellowship, will you be discussing outreach and how to better spread the message that these things are often connected?
Yes, we will be doing various trainings so that there can be more outreach. One of the things that is typically misknown or misunderstood about poverty in Arkansas is that people are choosing not to work, you know, or they've somehow landed in this position because of personal choice. And really what we want to have these faith leaders be able to help spread the message on is the fact that a lot of times people who are experiencing hard times financially have not chosen anything, and that actually they're doing a lot of things right. They're working several jobs, 2 and 3 jobs normally, but they still can't make ends meet. And so that really points to a larger issue of not personal choice, but what is going on with our jobs? What's going on with our economy? What's going on in our communities that people are working this hard and still are experiencing poverty at this alarming rate? In the study that the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation recently commissioned, it's called ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. We've seen that basically 50% of Arkansans before the pandemic were struggling to make ends meet. They were known as ALICE. That's too many households for my comfort. That cannot be that half of our state is just making wrong decisions, or half of our population just continue to fall on hard times because it's their fault. We really are hopeful that this program will give pastors and people of faith the language to begin spreading the message that there's more that we can do for our economy and the policies that go into our economy, and that these people are hardworking people. They are people who deserve dignity and respect, and that there's more that we can do to support them.
What can a minister, a rabbi, or a faith leader do to help understand not about food banks, but about greater long-term policies that make a difference?
Absolutely. Such a great question, Kyle. So one of the things, if you'll notice, we just recently came out of a legislative session in 2021, and we have those every couple of years. And this year was different, right? It was the pandemic. It was a lot of virtual settings. And so they didn't allow a lot of public hearings all the time or public testimony. But there were several instances where people of faith, pastors, clergy, came together to support or talk about bills or legislation as it, you know, intersected with something that they were passionate about. I think at WRF thinks as well that pastors can absolutely be a part of a conversation, you know, even if it's not at the legislative level, with their church members that says, hey, look, charity is nice. You know, the Bible says that the poor will always be with you. Jesus is very, very clear about the ways that we should treat the stranger, the people who are hungry, the people who are homeless. But there are also things in the Bible that tell us to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. And so this fellowship is named for that particular scripture, Micah 6:8, because we want pastors to feel equipped to talk not just about the charity lens, which is kind of a short-term fix, it's really a band-aid, but how do we eradicate these systems of poverty? What are the long-term things that we can do? Whether it's, you know, us changing policies, whether it's us supporting local small businesses to be able to pay a living wage, there are several things that we can do. And we think that pastors have a unique role in voicing that in their communities.
I know there was the phenomenon when vaccines for COVID-19 were first being rolled out that some people were hesitant until perhaps their personal doctor suggested that. Is there a potential similar phenomenon here that, oh, when my faith leader, who I see once, twice, three, four times a week, is talking about this in meaningful ways, it resonates more?
Absolutely. And of course, you know, we understand the very various needs for the separation of church and state. But if you have a personal relationship with your rabbi, with your pastor, with your minister, your priest, what have you, you have a level of trust with them, and you have a level of trust that they've done the necessary reading, research, study, and prayer to be able to offer good advice. So while they may not tell you, this is a policy that you should absolutely vote for, which, you know, it's probably good that they don't say those types of things, they can help you think more theologically about what it is your faith should compel you to do. You know, if our faith is one that says, that follows Jesus and subscribes to many of his teachings, then we should want to do more than just charity. We should not want to see people suffering in poverty for cycles of generations to come. We should want to do our parts to learn what we can do to make help these people to get out of poverty. So I absolutely think, in the same way that your doctor may or may not recommend for you to have the vaccine, our pastors and our faith leaders can absolutely be supportive in you making informed decisions about how to be engaged in anti-poverty work in Arkansas.
You mentioned the scriptural inspiration for the name of the fellowship, the Micah Fellowship. You don't have to go back that far to find the historical relationship between faith and helping people. I mean, it should go hand in hand.
It should go hand in hand. There are so many people here in our nation and across the globe who have really done a great work because of their faith to really push us towards being in right relationship with one another as humans, but also being in right relationship with our Creator. I can think of people like Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, for instance, who was doing a lot around not just race, but also around class and economy. More current right now, you can think of Reverend Dr. William Barber, who is the leader of the Moral Mondays and the Poor People's Campaign nationally. There are several different people, but you know, in our past, we can think of Fannie Lou Hamer and other people who came from the church, who spoke to such pressing needs of their day. And, you know, to be quite honest, we've all seen it in our churches. We've seen the deacons or, you know, the older women coming together to make sure that someone in need did not have to go without. And this is just an outgrowth of that.
Your first two degrees are in electrical engineering, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Can you make a comparison between the schematics? I'm not an electrical engineer. I hope I'm using that word correctly. The schematics of putting something together in engineering and trying to create a fellowship that will make things better for people?
Actually, yes, I probably can make that comparison. Thank you so much for asking me this. A lot of people I don't talk a lot about my career in engineering because a lot of times it doesn't intersect very clearly. But if I could give a comparison, I think I would say this. In my time as an engineer, I worked as a process control engineer in paper plants. My first job was at Evergreen Packaging, which used to be International Paper in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And what I was responsible for as a process control engineer was creating programs that made it easier for the machines to work and the operators to be able to control the machines, basically. Once you set a machine to work in automatic, it should be able to do what you need it to do, right? And so as I've been thinking about this program, this Micah Fellowship program and how it kind of intersects with the design process of what it would be when I was an electrical engineer, we want to create systems and create conversations and create relationships that make things easier for the most vulnerable people in our state, essentially. And so this program is a part of hopefully a larger system of not just faith leaders, but community leaders, city leaders, politicians, and just everyday Arkansans who want to make Arkansas the place to live. Right now, it's no joke. Everyone knows, it's not a secret. Arkansas is struggling to attract new folks to come and want to stay here, right? We don't boast the best jobs. We don't have like the greatest tourist place, but there's something about the hospitality that you get here. There's something about, you know, you never meet a stranger here. We want that to translate into the way that our economy works. We want our economy to be the most hospitable for everyone. And so this MICA Fellows program hopefully will be a part of a larger system that makes Arkansas a more attractive place to be and to live.
Reverend Chantel Hinton Hill is an equity officer with the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation. She spoke with us yesterday by Zoom. Applications to participate in the MICA Fellows program are being accepted now through July 1st. Much more information can be found at micafellowsprogram.org. Fellows accepted for the 9-month fellowship that begins in September will be notified of their acceptance by the end of July. And later on today's show, the land the University of Arkansas sits upon is the subject of this week's Hill Talk from Charlie Allison. From Osage to Old Main, the legacy of land takes the spotlight in this week's salute to 150 years of the University of Arkansas. That's in about 10 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
A listener from Eureka Springs recently said, "Many of us have said it in many different ways. NPR and KUAF are essential in their daily lives, and that is absolutely true for me as well. As KUAF approaches June, the last month in our financial year, we are raising the necessary funds to keep this essential public radio available in your community. Your gift to KUAF before June 30th will help us towards our goal of $35,000. Make your essential gift today at supportkuaf.com.
During the past year, you may have picked up a few more books than usual, but for one Fayetteville couple, the pandemic pushed them to open their own independent bookstore. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth brings us this report.
Inside of a mostly empty, dusty building on Center Street in Fayetteville, Daniel Jordan motions behind him.
So the front area, you know, is where Caskin Grove was. You can see the walls are down now. We're tearing down the walls and kind of just expanding back. So this space back here, kind of in the back, we're hoping will be like a children's section maybe, as well as, yeah, book club space.
The 2,600-square-foot space just off the downtown square was once a newspaper office and most recently an olive oil retailer. And soon, it will become the home of Pearl's Books.
And we were just kind of still exploring the idea of opening a bookstore. So I spent... We have a newborn, too, so, or she's 9 months old now. But so I spent a lot of time in the car driving around so that she would sleep. And so anyway, just kind of drove by here one day wondering what was here. And it was had just gone up for lease, I think, a couple weeks before. So we sort of happened into it. It was just perfect timing.
That's Leah Jordan, the co-owner of Pearl's Books and Daniel's wife. She says the idea to open their own independent bookstore became kind of an obsession during the COVID-19 pandemic.
This was for me sort of a dream that kind of sustained me throughout the pandemic. Like we were in the camp where we were able to work from home, and I had a baby in July of last year. We also have a 4-year-old. So we had that day-to-day work from home parent grind. That was kind of our COVID experience. And so opening a bookstore for me was the kind of, like, I just would daydream about it a lot. And I think it kind of got me through living in my house 24/7 for a year. And so then when Daniel was like, you know, let's actually think about this, that is why I was just so ready. And it has gone a lot faster than we expected, for sure.
Daniel says initially when Leah would talk about opening a bookstore, he didn't take it seriously. Until the pandemic, that is.
And I finally kind of came around to it. I think the pandemic was a big part of that mindset shift for me of, you know, if we're going to do something like this at some point in our lives, now is a good time to do it. There's no guarantees career-wise for what's going to happen. So yeah, it's been, we've learned so much since that moment about owning a small business and bookselling in particular. It's moved so fast.
It really has, yeah.
But I feel like, yeah, we've grown so much already.
From how to source and stock books to working with contractors and city ordinances to get their building ready, the couple says they had a lot to learn not only about owning a bookstore, but also opening a new business.
I mean, the answer is no. Neither of us have worked in a bookstore or opened a business. And so, yeah, definitely a learning curve. That's something that we've been really pleasantly surprised by, is that there's a lot of mentorship and community for booksellers. There's the American Booksellers Association. So we've been able to be in contact with a lot of other managers and owners of bookstores across the country. And everybody's been really gracious with their time. But we've had really a lot of mentorship from Facebook groups, and we've found too that a ton of people who have done what we're doing have zero background in bookselling as well. So that has also been really assuring.
The two also say they've had help from one of their favorite independent stores here in Fayetteville, Nightbird Books, which shut its doors in February of 2020. Leah says they've purchased some of Nightbird's shelves to use in their own store once it opens.
But yeah, I mean, when Nightbird closed, it was a huge gap that our community is missing now. I know we were super sad about it. So I think, yeah, we're excited to not replace Nightbird, but to feel like we're providing another kind of space that the community seems to really need and want. So
the Jordans say they want Pearls to be more than a bookseller. They want it to be a community space after a year of isolation.
It is a very individual experience reading a book, but when you can do that alongside other people and see how they are reacting and how they are growing and changing based on what they're reading, that's like, I don't know, perfect combination of what a community is and what it can be.
Yeah, just having kind of a designated space to encourage that. I mean, spiritual feels a little bit like a strong explanation, but I think it's true. And I personally, I really love children's books. That's one of the things that I'm most excited about with the store. And being able to just help children's their perspectives to grow and to see families interacting with the book, too. I mean, I think that that's just a really lovely idea. That's something we want for this space, just to be really warm and really inviting and really welcoming.
And the possibility for that seems hopeful as pandemic restrictions lift and more businesses open up. But the two say COVID-19 is still very much a concern.
We're hoping for fall. We're still...
August to October.
Yeah, sometime in that range. Yeah, who knows what it'll look like by then. But yeah, we'll definitely be keeping all of that stuff in mind.
Well, I mean, I can imagine having more limited capacity. Mm-hmm. We're still figuring out the logistics of how we're going to do it, but having curbside pickup and that type of thing for folks that don't want to come into the store. So
for now, though, the couple says they're just focused on trying to get the store open sometime this fall. Leah recently left her job at the University of Arkansas to pursue a degree in counseling, which is now on hold while she prepares to open the bookstore. And Daniel is still an academic advisor for the U of A, but is leaving that post in July.
And so I'll be quitting at the beginning of July and doing this full time. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're all in.
We're all in, yeah.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Monday night, the Razorback baseball team secured their place in the NCAA College Baseball Super Regionals with a 6-2 win over Nebraska. Immediately following, a batch of superfans secured their place in line to get tickets for Friday evening's game against North Carolina State. Three different groups of fans had set up canopies, one having a full-blown couch, another having a portable generator for lights and fans. Lance Staggs says it's not his first time camping out for tickets, and he loves the camaraderie it provides.
Well, I've been coming for several years. I just hooked up with these folks probably 5-6 years ago. And, you know, it's an event. I live for baseball. I have football tickets. And we have tailgates. But there's nothing like the friends you meet for baseball.
Hunter Sweat says this is his second week in a row camping out. and it's been worth it.
We've been out here since last Thursday, and it's been about the best time. You know, the two groups around us are guys we didn't know coming into this, and now we're all camped together and sitting together, so meeting new people, hanging out. That's what it's all about.
He says by waiting all week, he hopes Coach Van Horn and the team will see how much their fan base supports them.
We're not like any other school. We've got their back more than I hope any other fan base in the nation has, and, you know, I think they do this for or I know they do this for us, and we do it for them.
Steve Stumbaugh says when nature calls, they're more than prepared to use the porta-potties.
We brought Lysol, we got wet ones, and we got our own toilet paper if we feel the need to use the facility. Or if you have one of those, you know, moments of I can't make it to where I need to go, that's always the quick stop.
Arkansas hosts North Carolina State for a best-of-three regional beginning Friday evening at Baum Stadium. This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support for KUAF comes from the Malco Theaters, offering reserved seating at the Rogers Cinema Grill, Springdale Cinema Grill, and Razorback Cinema Grill and IMAX Theater in Fayetteville. Showtimes, tickets, and information available at Malco.com or the Malco app. KUAF is supported by Golan and Sharon CPAs, providing tax and accounting services to businesses and individuals. Located at 64 West Colt Square in Fayetteville, 521-0451 for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. University of Arkansas is marking 150 years this year and into the next. We're taking note most Wednesdays with Charlie Allison, the executive editor at University Relations. This week, Charlie is honoring an integral part of the university and a history that extends back further than the U of A.
Our story today is not about a historic person or building, not a Razorback tradition or a campus event. It's more foundational. And by foundational, I mean the bedrock the university is founded upon. Literally, I'm talking about the land upon which the university is located, the hill. And we should acknowledge the foundation of that bedrock. The land upon which the University of Arkansas sits is the historical and ancestral home of Native American tribes, which lived in these valleys and on these hills for hundreds of generations. The region was primarily home to the Osage Nation, whose annual hunting expeditions and travels brought them into the region now known as Northwest Arkansas. The Quapaw along the Mississippi River Valley and the Caddo to the south along the Red River Valley were also consistent travelers in this region. The first Europeans to enter this region were French explorers, and they claimed a huge swath of territory stretching from the Gulf of Mexico to the Great Lakes and from the Appalachian Mountains west to the Rockies. They made this land claim without really asking anyone who lived here, though. On the positive side, the French didn't go to any great lengths to oppose or depose the native nations, instead working with them on trapping, hunting, and agrarian enterprises for the most part. No, the real problems came after the French sold the Louisiana Purchase to the Americans, who saw the region as a land to be possessed and tamed and sold. The first treaty affecting the land now inhabited by the university came in 1808. The Americans wanted the Osage Nation to cede to the United States all of its land east of Fort Clark. That amounted to nearly all of present-day Missouri south of the Missouri River, and nearly all of present-day Arkansas north of the Arkansas River. The Osage would be allowed to live and hunt on the land, outside of white settlements, of course, but the land would belong to the United States, a notation probably without much meaning to the Osage leaders. The Treaty of Fort Clark drew a line due south from the fort to the Arkansas River. That line runs parallel to the western boundary of the university campus, about a half mile west of Reynolds Razorback Stadium. In subsequent years, tribal nations in the east were forced by the United States to leave their homelands and remove west, many of them settling in Arkansas before being forced further west into what was labeled the Indian Territory. Among the native immigrants were three contingents of Cherokees from northern Georgia and Alabama who came through the Fayetteville area. In the winter of 1838-39, one of those contingents, which numbered about 1,200 people, camped for a night on the south side of the present-day campus. A small park just south of the Razorback soccer field commemorates their stay. So today, we who use this campus for learning, for work, for research, at a minimum, we owe a debt of gratitude to those indigenous colleagues living and working among us on campus. We owe them recognition and respect. We owe them solidarity and partnership in future endeavors. With that bedrock understood, I'll try to offer a few more thoughts about the land. A year prior to statehood in 1835, the 65 acres of land that make up the central part of campus today were purchased by two land speculators, W.D. Hart and J.M. Hoag, and immediately they sold the next day to George Freischlag, a German immigrant who had already bought the 40 acres that cover the Maple Hill section of campus. A little more than 20 years later, in 1857, William McElroy purchased the Freischlag property for $500, as well as 40 acres in the valley where Reynolds Razorback Stadium and Barnhill Fieldhouse are today, for another $100. The McElroy family established a farm across the hilltop, while William McElroy ran a mercantile store on the Fayetteville Square. The luxury of being both a shopkeeper and farmer was probably due to his ownership of six slaves prior to the Civil War. In 1871, after the war, the Board of Trustees of the university visited the hilltop McElroy farm and found it to be, quote, second to none. Second to none in the state as a location for the university. The McElroys were persuaded to sell the farm for $11,000 in December 1871, and the university opened its classroom doors just over a month later, using the McElroy farmhouse and a hastily built two-story schoolhouse. In 1874, Albert W. Bishop, the second president of the university, imagined the future of the campus. He noted that a commanding building and an experimental farm would, quote, soon grace yonder hillside. The commanding building of which he spoke was, of course, Old Main, still under construction at the time. One of the oddities of the hill is best described using Old Main as an example. The venerable old building sits right on top of what I call the Boston Mountain Divide. There is probably a real geographer's name for it, but I haven't found it so far. You've probably heard of the Continental Divide, that high line following the middle of the Rocky Mountains that marks the separation of all the waters flowing east that eventually end up in the Gulf of Mexico, and all of the waters flowing west that end up in the Pacific Ocean. Well, Arkansas has a similar line dividing the White River Basin to the north and the Arkansas River Basin to the south. The line runs through Roger, Springdale, and Fayetteville, west along part of Lafayette Street and over the top of Mount Nord, and then right across the middle of campus. If you were to walk out the north end of Old Main and throw a bucket of water upon the ground, the water would flow into one of those river basins. And if you walked out the south door and did the same, it would flow to the other basin. Ironically, though, a curling of tributaries in the Fayetteville area causes a sort of yin and yang geometric design on the landscape, with creeks and tributaries arcing gracefully around one another and creating an unexpected twist. The water tossed north out of Old Main will end up in the Arkansas River to the south, and the water tossed south out of Old Main will end up in the White River to the north. So if you feel a little topsy-turvy now, you have just the smallest inkling of what it might feel like to have your ancestral land, a space as communal as the air and water, taken away and separated into little parcels of individually possessed dirt. And when you walk across the heights of campus, remember the figurative divide between the admiration and memories that you and I might have for the landscape of today, and the veneration of the many indigenous peoples who see the same hilltop as ancestral land.
Charlie Allison is executive editor with University Relations at the University of Arkansas. You can learn about events and commemorations associated with the U of A sesquicentennial at 150.uark.edu. This is Ozarks at Large. With me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Courtney Lanning, film critic for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Welcome back.
Thanks again for having me.
Two movies we're talking about today.
Yeah, surprise.
So first, let's talk about In the Heights, which is going to be on HBO Max and in theaters tomorrow. It's a musical, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Of course.
Of course, now when we think Lin-Manuel Miranda, we think Hamilton.
Right.
Is this a fair comparison?
That's what everybody's going to be thinking of. I mean, I believe he actually wrote this play first. It debuted in 2005, went to Broadway in 2008, and actually won the Tony for Best Musical that year. And of course, that's all before Hamilton came and supersized him even more.
Right. Hamilton, of course, which Disney had and still has, was filmed as a theatrical production. It was as if you were in the theater. In the Heights is a movie.
Right. And, you know, there's always a really big risk for movie studios that are trying to translate musicals into film. It's a very difficult task, and sometimes they don't exactly pull it off. I'm thinking of Rock of Ages back in, I think, 2005.
Oh, wow. Someone has to think of Rock of Ages, I suppose. So does In the Heights pull it off?
I think it does. It's fantastic. The music, the dance, it's all pure fire. It's nonstop energy from the opening song all the way to the very end. And it's definitely a movie you're going to want to see, even if you don't regularly go to the Walton Arts Center or wherever you go to watch musicals.
You saw a preview copy, which means you watched it in your house, your home.
Right.
It looks like from the previews this is spectacle. So did it translate as spectacle for you?
I feel like it did. There's a couple of really neat optical things that they're able to do in film. I'm thinking towards the end, there's a scene where two of the main characters are dancing on the side of a building while they're thinking about the sun going down. And that's something that you can do in a movie that you obviously can't do in a musical. So they do a lot of creative things in the Heights that you definitely can't get away with on a stage production.
So that's worth seeing.
Definitely. If you love Hamilton, you'll love In the Heights. And of course, Lin-Manuel is in this movie as well.
That's right. All right. Now, Wish Dragon, you kind of promoted this, told me last week you might be reviewing this. I don't know what Wish Dragon is.
Right. This is on part of Netflix's summer release slate. Netflix, as you know, has been beefing up their content year after year, putting out more and more. They've released some really great movies over the last couple years. And this is coming out on Friday. This is sort of like a Chinese take on Aladdin. It's about a really hardworking guy who was trying to win back a girl from his childhood, and he's given a dragon that grants him three wishes.
All right. Well, you mentioned Aladdin. I mean, that's among many a beloved Robin Williams, right?
Of course.
Yeah. So does this have that sort of manic energy and touch that Aladdin did?
You know, it really doesn't. There's elements of a good movie in Wish Dragon, but the movie never really brings it all together to make a complete, decent film. I mean, if you want to watch a story about someone being granted three wishes and true love and all that, you're better off watching 1992's Aladdin.
Okay.
Disney told this story better.
Good for all ages?
Yeah, I mean, it's harmless. It's not an awful movie. It gets close to being a good movie. It just never quite crosses that line.
Yeah, and it's on Netflix.
Sure.
So
if you're already paying for the subscription.
Yeah, there you go.
It's not going to hurt you to watch it.
Okay.
But if you got Disney Plus, boot up Aladdin instead.
Okay. So see In the Heights, watch Aladdin, and then next week, Peter Rabbit 2.
Peter Rabbit 2, which is, of course, based off the stories by Beatrix Potter.
Right. Yes, I actually saw the screenplay credits, and it was a story by Beatrix Potter. Screenplay by like five more people. So obviously this is going to be some sort of modern take. And it's called, I think, subtitled The Runaway?
Yes. Okay. And I think the original came out in 2018 and actually made a pretty decent chunk of change. I think somewhere near $350, $400 million, which is pretty good for an animated movie. It's already been opened in Australia and the UK, and now America's going to get a chance to watch Peter Rabbit on Friday.
All right. I'm glad you're watching this because you don't like scary movies. I don't like movies where an animal gets lost.
That's kind of hard to sit through.
It's stressful. So I can't wait to hear. I mean, it's Peter Rabbit 2. I'm sure they want Peter Rabbit 3, so I'm sure it doesn't end in tragedy. But
you would think.
Yeah, you would think, right. All right, Courtney Lanning is a film critic with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. You can read her full reviews of Wish Dragon and In the Heights this Friday.
Right, and next week, looking at Pixar's Luca.
Luca?
Yes. It's Pixar's newest animated hit.
Okay.
About two mermen who come aboard on land in Italy and have a crazy adventure.
I can't wait to hear about that. Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you.
KUAF is giving away tickets to the 2021 Spaceberry Music Festival, July 1st through the 3rd, on the farm in Eureka Springs. This three-day festival welcomes Talk, Forgotten Space, Steady Flow, and more. Winners announced Friday, June 25th, during Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com for registration and more information. KUAF is supported by Arcega's drive-thru location at 1509 MLK in Fayetteville. open 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. with a full coffee menu, espresso options, seasonal drinks, and a small foods menu. Arcegas.com or Facebook for more. The July 4th Fireworks Spectacular featuring Sona Symphony of Northwest Arkansas is Sunday, July 4th at the Walmart Amp in Rogers. This family-friendly event includes patriotic music, fireworks, and more. Gates open at 6 p.m., concert at 7:30. Fireworks begin at 9:15. AmpTickets.com for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. Thanks for your continued support. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of our show. John McDonald's career in collegiate sports is unparalleled. During 36 years as the head men's track and field coach at the University of Arkansas, he collected 40 national championships, 19 for indoor track, 11 for cross country, 10 for the outdoor program. From 1984 to 2000, at least one of his teams collected a national championship. He was awarded a National Coach of the Year honor 30 times. He was a Conference Coach of the Year, either in the Old Southwest Conference or the SEC, 49 times. He was also a beloved teacher, family member, and community figure. He passed away Monday night at age 82. In March 2013, John McDonald came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about his then just published memoir from the University of Arkansas Press. He spent most of our conversation talking about others he admired and loved, and part of our conversation was about another Arkansas track legend, Olympic gold medalist Mike Connolly.
Well, it just felt like it was the man above must be taking care of him because, you know, Mike Connolly and the man I was showing you, Frank Murphy, Mike Connolly, great. I mean, not they were great athletes, but they were even better people. And when young guys started coming in for recruiting visits, man, I didn't have enough scholarships to give out. You know, they all wanted to come because, man, I heard about O'Shaughnessy, I heard about Mike Connolly, and they are really nice guys, and they were.
And Connolly seems to be a kindred spirit with you because there's the one meet that you talk about where he's already doing the long jump, he's already doing the triple jump, he's already in a couple of runs, and he tells you he's going to anchor another relay.
Yeah,
he right. wants more points, and you say, hold on.
I said to him, Mike, you know, I don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. I said, enough is enough. You're not going to run it. And he said, no, we might need the points. You know, at the end there, we might need the points. And I said, well, if we do, we do. But I said, you're not going to get hurt doing it, you know. And as it turned out, we won it anyways. But that was the type. He was the only guy that used to come into my office. I always studied the meet beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I really knew what the other teams had pretty good. And he came into the first championship that we won. He said, how many points have you down? I said, 90. 90. And he said, I got 92. And I said, we're over the events and they were amazingly close. Mm. And here's this jumper now.
Right.
My gosh, some jumpers never even know that there's distance runners. Where he had figured out how good our distance runners were and every event down. And he came up to 1600 relay, the last event. And he said, "We'll get 8 points. We'll get second there. We cannot win." I said, "Oh," I said, "No, we're not going to run it because we're not good enough. We don't have." And he said, "Oh, I'll anchor it."
You mentioned that as a runner, you learned from your mistakes. You learned to hold back. You also write that you learned as a coach. You were a coach for a long time, and sometimes you learn from the athletes, just like they always learn from you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, my saying was, you can learn more from listening than talking. And let the athlete, let him have his day, you know. And I used to always sit down and ask him what those young guys, what were your goals and where do you want to go? And, of course, sometimes their goals are humongous, you know, and they want it now, not 2 years later. Mm-hmm. And then after I knew what they wanted, I'd say, hey, well, you and I are on the same page, but we might try and tweak a few things, you know. I said, you had a great high school coach. Never knock the high school coach. That's not a good thing to do because the kid that comes in that believes in his high school coach, you better not go and say, well, hey, you're in Arkansas now and you're in college and that was high school. We're changing the whole thing. Don't ever do that. I never did that because you pull the rug out from under them, you know, a security blanket.
One thing I took from this book is that one thing you don't like is complacency.
Yes.
Fair?
That's fair.
One of the athletes says, you know, this is after you've won a good number of national championships, one of your athletes said, "Coach, you're never going to be happy." And he said, "Yeah, I'm happy."
I remember that happened not just for one, but I remember one in particular, and he was really happy that he made the final at the conference meet. He was a 1,500-meter kid, and he improved from high school. And he was going around giving high fives to everybody. And I said, "What are you so happy about?" He said, "Well, I had a personal best by 3 seconds in the metric mile." And I said, "Are you in the final?" And he said, "Well, no, but I'm just a freshman." I said, "I don't care if you're a freshman. It doesn't matter who gets the points. We never look at them for the freshmen or seniors, you know." So, boy, he said, "Well, you're never happy." Walked off, but then later I gave a pat in the back, and I said, "Hey, you had a great race and better to come, but don't ever settle for second best."
When you're a coach of a team, you're like a CEO. And so you have to manage. You have to know who to stroke, who to encourage. How did you learn that?
Well, I'll tell you what. I learned that from my college coach. He was a terrific motivator. Absolutely. He was on his own. Back then, most colleges didn't have assistants. If they had, it was a grad assistant. But he would get the guys so fired up for the conference meet, and he spoke to them and talked to them individually. You know, mm-hmm. He did it to me too. And walk out of there, walking out on air, you know, out of his room, his office, because I felt, dang, that guy really thinks I'm great. You know,
were you ever too hard on yourself?
I'll tell you the one thing I made coaching is a tough career, and to do it right, it takes 100%. John Wooden said 97% is as much as he ever got out of anybody. But I think 100% of your time, and sometimes I think I neglected, going home, back home to Ireland. After I came to Arkansas, I didn't go home for 15 years. And when I went back after those 15 years, that's when I realized, heck, I'm an old guy. Because I met some of my schoolmates, and my brother introduced me and said, you know him. I said, I think I know the face. And then when he told me who he was, I said, "Wow." I said, "Do I look that old?" You know? He said, "Yep."
Yeah, that's the realization. Not because you see yourself in the mirror every day, but when you see your contemporaries. Yeah.
And some of them were, you know, younger than I, they looked pretty good. But there was a few of them that said, "Oh my gosh." And that I came back, and my wife was over there, and the kids were with us. But I said, "I'm going to spend a little bit more time with my family, because time is just slipping away."
You have all those rings, all those championships, all those conference championships, national championships. But you can go around Northwest Arkansas and see some of the athletes who ran for you having very successful lives. You drive around, there's David Swain with a company. Yeah. Seneca Lassiter and all the coaches that are around. Yes. That's got to make you feel very good.
It does, because there for years, none of my athletes went into coaching at all. And I always told them, "You're better off not. You know, it's not for a family. It's tough on a family to be a coach, because you got to put so many hours, and many things can happen. Could get into trouble or something like that. They call the coach, and whether it's 5 o'clock in the evening or 5 o'clock in the morning, you got to go and check it out." But I was very fortunate that I'm not bragging about it, but a very little problems that we, because we had strict rules about alcohol and all that type of stuff and drugs. I had a rule where one time if you get involved with drugs, you're gone.
Zero.
Yeah. No second chance at all. And alcohol, we always said, you know, if you get intoxicated and it comes to my desk, there'll be consequences. And then the second time, I call your parents. Yeah. So we didn't have much problem. Now, I'm not saying the guys didn't have a few beers and all that.
But, yeah, and the ones who are coaches and then the ones who have the businesses or have made a great success and stayed here, Ruben Reyna, you see, and O'Mara down in Little Rock.
Yeah.
There's a great legacy there.
Oh, yeah, there is. And you know, there's a lot of them are doctors and all that. I think 17 of them went on to be doctors. And it's nice to get to the most, sometimes the most gratifying thing is I've had letters when I retired from kids that were on the team that weren't, never scored a point, you know, in a conference meet, but thanking me for what I did for them as a person, straightened them out and kept them on the team and all that type of stuff. So it was, that's gratifying. You never think about that you do somebody a favor, but in their eyes, it was great to be just a part of it.
Finally, very few of us when we're young know where we're going to go. But you're a teenager in Ireland, and then you look back and see who you're standing next to in some of these pictures. There's Roger Bannister handing you an award. There's the future president of the United States when Governor Bill Clinton handing you an award for the first national championship. The Prime Minister of Ireland. I mean, it's been a wild, fun ride, hasn't it?
It has. I'll tell you, it has been an unbelievable trip when I look back on it, because just a poor farm boy from Ireland, and one of eight kids in tough times, just right after I was born in the middle of World War II, you know, so 1938, so there were tough times. I can remember in 44, I think it was, when there were still planes flying around, and we used to, when the planes, the Ireland was not involved, even though it got bombed a couple of times, Dublin did, but you know, those planes scared the heck out of you, because everybody thought they were fighter planes, you know.
Sure. Congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Charlie.
The late John McDonald talking with us in March 2013 about his memoir published by the University of Arkansas Press. John McDonald died Monday night at the age of 82. This is Ozarks at Large.
For the Central Arkansas Library System, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. The Arkansas Association of Colored Women was formed in 1905, adopting the slogan of its national organization, Lifting as We Climb, and working to improve conditions in African-American communities across the state. The association pursued that goal in different ways through the years, focusing on health issues and protection of Black women and girls in the 1930s, improvements in community resources opposing racial violence in the 1940s, addressing rapid changes in race relations in the 50s and 60s, and supporting educational opportunities for young Black women in the 1970s. Though its numbers are lower, the association is still active in the 21st century, assisting the many people displaced by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005 and the people of Dumas after a 2007 tornado. Now the Arkansas Association of Women, Youth, and Young Adults Club, the organization celebrated its 110th anniversary in 2015, still following the motto, Lifting as We Climb. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Springdale. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors this Wednesday included Daniel Carruth, Matthew Moore, who talked to those Arkansas Razorback baseball superfans for our show, Charlie Allison and Courtney Lanning. Timothy Dennis produced today's show in the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio. The Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute, created by Mark Crist. Additional content today provided by our friends and colleagues at KUAR, Public Radio for Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Thanks so much for being with us on this Wednesday. We will be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m., new edition of our Thursday, Ozarks at Large. You can also find us in past shows at ozarksatlarge.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Have a good day.